Melinda Stoltzfu Spanished on her way home from church in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Her quiet Amish community had their innocence shattered as the world watched the investigation unfold. This is Keystone Crimes by Abigail Martin.
Investigators have reason to believe Stoltzfu was harmed following her abduction. We are doing everything we can to find Linda and to bring her home to secure justice for her family and the community.
Searches for Linda are ongoing. This case will not be closed until we locate Linda Stoltzfus.
Episode 5, The Media. There was no shortage of media attention when it came to the case of Linda Stoltzfus. Everywhere you looked, there were people writing about Linda's case, using every piece of information they could get their hands on. Readers were clamoring for more, almost desperate to know everything that happened to the missing girl. This curiosity stretched on for months. From the moment Linda went missing to the day her body was found, the media was there, searching for their next headline. It was their job to keep the community updated whenever and wherever they could, no matter the endless amount of time and work they had put in to doing it correctly. I talked to three reporters from Lancaster Newspaper and Lancaster Online, a daily newspaper headquartered in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Abby King, Ty Lohr, and Dan Neefen.
My name is Dan Neefen. I'm a news reporter at LNP. I do a lot of crime-type stories, more trend, larger piece than something just happened, like, you know, a DUI or a robbery or something like that. It's supposed to be a little more deeper and involved, but you often get pulled into breaking news. And we knew that a woman had been missing, and it would be unusual for an Amish woman to go, a young Amish woman to go missing. So, you know, we kind of thought something was up right away, but it was just more in the first couple days like a search for this missing woman. And I don't think the public at large presumed that something bad had happened initially. And like a couple days into it, it was just like, you know, can you make a call to police? Apparently the FBI are helping. Can you see what that's about? So, but by then, Ty had already been well involved in going out there.
My name is Ty Lohr, two separate names. I'm a breaking news journalist at LNP, and I work the day shift. So I think the first time I heard about it, it was just, you know, we get so many missing persons happen, you know, and it's just kind of run of the mill. It was kind of odd, but it didn't seem too out of the ordinary. And then it was like the second day, there was a search party. And because of my background in photography and videography, I went out there and I did some photos of the search party. And that's kind of when it started seeming like it was different. I mean, like, we noticed that there was a big, the search party for Linda was a lot different than like search parties before, because the Amish community came out in mass and there were a ton of them there. And it seemed like that was like a staple. They searched day after day after day. And I covered the first one. And then just in my role, because of working in the mornings, it was always like, come in, check on Linda Stoltzfus, make a call to the PIO, which is the public information officer, at the time at East Lampeter, and just kind of seeing what the updates were, what was going on. And it was kind of, like Dan said, it was unusual, but nobody was thinking like anything crazy had happened, I don't think. I mean, a lot of everything was being thrown around. Did she just wander off? Did she run away? Was she tired of being Amish? Every idea that you would think of was being tossed out there. But I mostly covered it from a when things broke on it, I covered them. And then like when new news happened on it. And then from a photo and video standpoint, I did most of that stuff.
At the time Linda went missing, Abby King was only 7 months into her career as a journalist, and she was perfectly aware that this case was unlike anything she had taken on before.
I had never reported on anything as serious or kind of out of the blue like this. You know, I'd covered shootings that happened in the city over, you know, conflicts and fights, you know, things that escalated, but this really just felt very random, I guess. And it was the first time I think I had reported on a young girl who had been killed. And specifically, obviously, like the fact that she was Amish, like that was not something we really dealt with much at all. Was, you know, conflict or issues with the Amish aside from, you know, like farm accidents and things like that. So it was really a really unique case when compared to other things I had reported on.
It was impossible to ignore the elephant in the room. Linda Stoltzfus was a young Amish girl that had disappeared from a quiet, seemingly harmless community. This isn't something that you saw in the headlines every day or got read to you by the nightly news anchor. This was different. And because of that, the media was all over it.
The unusual thing with this case was that it was a young Amish woman missing. And the Amish are like sort of insular. They're like apart from, quote, the English, which would be people who are not Amish. So they're, I mean, if you live in Lancaster, you see them, you see Amish people all the time, but they, you know, in a way kind of keep to themselves and in their own community. So that after a while, as Ty was saying, there was some initial, or, you know, fairly early on, wonderment, could she have, like, wanted to leave the Amish community? And there was nothing pointing to that from authorities that they had relayed to us from their family. But it just would be really, really, really unusual that somebody would just vanish without a trace from that kind of community. And usually you'd be able to leave digital footprints or something they would be able to find. So, you know, find if she had, like, willingly left. So there's that it's a unusual community that people have just a lot of curiosity about. Like, tourism is a huge area here, or a huge interest in Lancaster County. So you have that. And then if she did really go missing, was she abducted by a stranger? And true stranger crimes are also extremely rare. If something bad happens to you, most of the time it's somebody close to you. So it had two things kind of going for it that would be attractive. I mean, not that we want bad things to happen, but just two compelling human interest narratives there.
Yeah, so like I said, we've had plenty of missing persons, and usually they're quick turnaround. I mean, that day, I think the biggest thing that kind of struck me was, like I said, there were so many people showing up for the search party, especially that first day. And if you're thinking, okay, she kind of just wanted to leave, she walked away or whatever, you can't, especially in the Amish community, because they're so, like Dan said, just kind of insulated within themselves. It's not like it would be ordinary for them to be miles and miles away from where they grew up and where their families are and their churches are and their communities are. So I think after like a week, it became really odd, and it just sparked more questions like, did she want to leave? Did she get abducted? I mean, like Dan was saying, true stranger crimes are just very, very, very out of the ordinary. And especially, I think at this point, I had been, you know, on breaking news here for over a year, and it seemed like most missing people cases were done and like solved within days, usually, maybe a week. And if it was a week, it was like this teenager maybe stayed out at their friend's house or something like that. So I think the fact that there were no signs that she had wanted to leave, the way that she had left, coming back from church, leaving no trace, you know, she had a large family, and according to her family, a good friend group too. So I think it just seemed very different in a lot of ways, because it was very much like something we weren't used to covering, because there were no digital footprints. There, you know, we couldn't just go and sleuth on their Facebook and see what they were looking at or liking or anything like that. It was very much like without a she disappeared without a trace. I mean, it was just very, very odd.
The fact that, you know, this young woman who, you know, we think of the Amish as pure, you know, godly people, for her to be, you know, kidnapped, and then later we find out, you know, she was killed. It was a big deal, you know. It's like we think of the Amish as like good people who are essentially sinless, which is incorrect, obviously, because no one everybody does something wrong at least once in their life, if not a million times a day, right? And, but, you know, we kind of hold the Amish up.
And the reporters that covered this case were well aware of this difference. It was sitting right in front of them.
Yeah, so Lancaster is known for its Amish communities in tourism and everything like that, like Dan was saying. But I think this really sparked a big interest because she was a young 18-year-old Amish woman that seemed like there were just, she had zero reason to leave. And it just seemed very odd that she would leave in the fashion that she left, or disappeared, I should say, in the fashion that she disappeared. And I think because of how close-knit the Amish community are, it really brought a lot more attention because there were just so many unanswered questions. And it was also a big public interest because of the fact that this is a, for lack of a better term, a very interesting group of people who a lot of people don't know a lot about but are really interested in. And it seemed like it brought up more questions than if it was just a regular, not regular, but English missing woman, where you could try to track cell phones, or you could try to track, you know, calls, or you could try to reach out to friends and stuff like that. But her friends, her family, nobody had any connection to the digital world. I mean, she left her money behind. So I think just the fashion that she left, and the way that she, like, you know, walked away from church and then just kind of disappeared, and it was something that she did so often. It was so routine. It just seemed so odd, and I think that it really sparked a lot of interest, mostly because of the fact that she was from the Plain community and because there's so much interest and curiosity drawn to that community.
The public's interest was not only drawn in because of who Linda was, but because of her community as a whole. People travel from all around the world to catch a glimpse into the bubble of the Amish community in Lancaster. Tours travel to their cow farms, and families take fake buggy rides to experience the more simplistic way of their life that they're so fascinated by. But now, they've been given the opportunity to see this world on a wide platform. They were hooked from the very beginning. And this attention had an impact on how the case was reported and researched as a whole.
I was involved in Facebook groups where people were like, had prayer groups for her, or like sharing tips and just like bringing out sleuths and people praying from her or for her from like all over the world. I ended up interviewing a woman from, I think, Virginia, and then one from Tennessee, who were, you know, moderators of one of these Facebook groups, and they shared information, you know, all the time, and they got to know people related to the family, and they had, you know, good information, and, you know, would share it with me.
In my reporting, a lot of what I did was I just scoured the Facebook pages that people created for Linda and finding her and details about the case. Like, I scoured those daily for tips, because people from all over, you know, like internet sleuths, were putting in a lot of work. Or at least as a reporter, I was able to discover more because so many people were so interested in what was going on. Do I think people were out of line at times when it came to the Facebook group? Of course. I think we have to be really careful when we are acting as internet sleuths. It's really easy for us to like find all this information about people and their personal lives, but it doesn't necessarily mean that like that's information that is relevant or necessary. And it can also be really harmful to the families involved when we go up digging things from their past.
More often than not, the amount of time and effort these reporters put into the case didn't get the recognition it deserved. Instead, their boots on the ground work was often stolen by larger and louder media outlets.
You know, I've been in enough other newspapers and news outlets that, you know, sometimes there are cases where you're hustling with, you know, other people. Here, our direct competitors, I felt, were like, you know, the TV stations, because, you know, they know this community. Somebody, and I don't recall if like there was a New York Times article or anything like that, but I think, you know, we know this community better than outsiders would. So, you know, I don't know that it did, but for law enforcement, you know, if they might be getting calls left and right from a lot more reporters than they normally would. So,
I will say that as a reporter, it was often frustrating because of the wide media attention. Because, you know, that was my like I reported on the disappearance, Linda's disappearance for, you know, weeks, months. That was like, you know, a big project for me. And so I'd, you know, put in all this work and time, publish stories, and then, you know, see that like other media outlets are using my information. And like, sure, maybe they're hyperlinking back, you know, they're adding a link to my original reporting, but like, it's frustrating when you're the one that's putting all the time and energy into your community, trying to report the facts, and then someone just kind of like drops in and takes credit for what you do. I don't know. It's, you know, obviously it's like, it's not about me. It was about like the facts that I was reporting out, but it's still like, local journalism gets such a, we kind of get the, we get the shortest straw, you know, when compared to like national news outlets.
A lot of these national outlets were, it's not like they were sending boots on the ground in, for the most part. They were pulling from their affiliates, like, you know, NBC might pull from like WGAL and ABC, we have a local affiliate too. And just to be blunt, a lot of them were ripping off our reporting and just throwing it under, you know what I mean, national reports. So it's not like it was hard for us to get information because of the national attention that it gained, I don't think, because we had, I mean, between Dan and I, we had pretty good relationships with East Lampeter Police, State Police at the time, and, you know, and then Dan was talking with the FBI. I think that's the only thing that really differed is the amount of people that we had to call to try to get information from became a longer list than usually. You know, it's like, okay, local police, then maybe state police. But now it was local police, state police, and they refer everything to the FBI, and the FBI is referring everything back to the local police, and they don't want to say anything because the FBI is lead investigating on, or the lead investigator on this. And so because they were working together, I think it kind of just made some communication unclear, but I wouldn't say like it hindered it or made it more difficult. It just made it different.
Instead of digging up insensitive information that had the potential to cause more harm than good, a major focus was placed on building strong, solid relationships with those involved in the case. But these attempts didn't come without challenges.
Making connections with both families, the Stoltzfuses and the Smokers, that's always really hard. To do, you know, the family of someone who's inflicting violence, but then also creating those strong relationships with the Amish community. You know, they don't like to be in the paper. They tend to, you know, go without, if they can, without like a last name. And like I've written stories about Amish people before, and it was always such a struggle to get people to go on their record. Because it's just not part of their, like, they don't, it's not acceptable to be talking to the newspaper. And maybe in this case, it would have been different, because that's the only way you can really, you know, tell both sides of the story. Or get a better understanding about why things like this happen, or what impact it has on those involved. The only way is to you know, touch base, to communicate with the people involved.
Every interaction I've ever had with anybody in the playing community has always been extremely nice, even if they don't want to talk, you know. So I don't think it was hard because we wanted to be involved in we wanted to cover some of these things, and we did. We got to cover a lot of these things. But I think like it was all kind of uncharted territory as far as how we cover these things.
You know, after Eusto Smoker had been charged, there were times I had to go to the family and try to talk to them, which was no different than going to, you know, anybody else. It's a you know, their daughter was missing. It was clear at that point that something bad had happened to her, whether or not, you know, authorities officially said. I mean, because, you know, another aspect of this was it was like 3 weeks or close to 3 weeks from the time she went missing till Eusto Smoker was arrested. So, you know, that's a fair amount of time. And then there's no body, and he's charged, you know, So it's sort of like a mystery of what happened to her. But it's never easy as a reporter to go to a family whose child or, you know, relative is missing or probably dead or something bad has happened to them. And some people will want to talk, some people won't. So the fact that they were Amish, you know, I had to get over that, and just, you know, go and try to ask them, and, you know, they would say, you know, no comment, or sometimes I'd leave a note in their door and, you know, apologize for having to talk to them or try to talk to them in such a circumstance. But, you know, if they wanted to say anything, there was my number to let me know. So I would say law enforcement was tight as a clam. You were not getting anything out of them. It would just be like, you know, no comment, we can't talk about that, you know, anything will come in court filings or whatever. So I did develop some relationships in and out of law enforcement with people connected with the case that did help a little bit. But I mean, there were times I learned that the body was found or likely found, and I was working on like a whole different story related to it, but it was late in the day and I'm like, I'm getting word that, you know, a body might have been found. So I had to hustle, and I'm trying to contact my people in law enforcement, and I'm getting pushback and no comment, and I'm like, all right, just the way they're responding or not responding is telling me something. So, you know, I drove out to the house. There's a cop parked nearby, and I'm like, oh yeah, something's happening today. And then they put out a news release, and then we learned where the body was. And then it was interesting. By the time he pled, you learned a bit more that wasn't in court documents, or you just learned a little bit more. It's like, well, law enforcement knew a lot more than they were, you know, letting on. And I understand they have to protect the case, but there was just so much curiosity and interest in it. And we're not necessarily driving it. You know, we're not saying, oh, what fact can we put out or what tidbit can we put out? I mean, people are hungering for this, you know, this story. People could say the media just wants to put out bad news, but we have metrics and see what people write. They're reading this kind of stuff. And there was, again, we already talked about the unusual facets about this case, but people want to know more about bad stuff than, though they say they want to know good stuff, they're not reading that as much. So
there was also a difference in reporting on this case compared to others in the past. The reporters working on this didn't go in completely blind to who Justo Smoker was and what his past was like. They had a step up from the rest, an advantage that helped them in more ways than one.
We did know so much about him right away. We had stories written about, because when he was originally convicted, or initially, I should say, convicted of armed robbery, we had that initial story, and we had talked to his family, and we knew his background, and that's a lot of stuff that you really don't know about a lot of people who are charged with crimes. I mean, usually when people are charged with crimes, it's a lot of, you just have to wait and get information out. It was very odd that we had so much, I shouldn't say odd, it was very interesting and different that we had so much information on somebody who was just convicted, or charged, I should say, with this. We knew a lot more about his background than we would have if it was anybody else, really. If it was a first-time offender, I should say.
While we didn't have official information coming from authorities, you couldn't get, you know, more records that you would have wanted to because things were closed. We did cover who he was in his earlier criminal involvement. So when it, you know, one thing you always do is try to research as much about anybody, and often your own archives, your past stories can be a help, and we have a pretty good, you know, archive system. So that stuff was pulled in, and it's like, okay, so it's a stranger who abducts her, and then people are trying to find out, could they have known each other, and it was pretty clear to me that wouldn't have been, but you find out that, you know, he had been this kid who, you know, had a bad backstory, but was adopted by this like loving family, by all accounts, and given opportunities. And he was a wrestler, an outstanding student, but then he's also committing armed robberies with his brother. So it's like, what, you know, what goes wrong? What happens? you know, to make somebody, you know, like that.
But even though they had all this information on the offender, it was a delicate balance between wanting to get all the information possible out to the public while simultaneously trying to be aware of how the release of this information affects all the families involved.
I had discovered some information about Justo Smoker's life and the things that he and his family had gone through. And, you know, people that he had spent time with who just really did not believe that he was capable of murdering Linda, and how that was impacting them. And with things like that, it's just, you know, that didn't make it in. Those things didn't make it in because they either weren't relevant, you know, to Justo. It would only bring more pain to the family. More stress, more of a spotlight on the negative parts of their lives. And the thing is that sometimes it's like, so when Justo was first charged, you know, we immediately, the entire digital news team at LNP, we all hopped on our computers and started digging. Okay, what can we find about him? What do we have about him in our archives? What can we find about him, you know, just like through simple internet searches. And so, you know, we published that story, I guess that would have been like June 21st, 22nd, something like that, of 2020. You know, we published that, like, who is Justo Smoker, you know, this is everything we know about him. We've published that story. And then, you know, months later, you might find information about him or his family or, you know, who he was. But at that point, it's not enough for, you know, a whole standalone story. And sure, maybe you could go back and add it to, you know, what do we know about Justo Smoker? But sometimes it's just like, that's just, you're getting too far in the weeds. And it's just not relevant to what's going on. It helps paint a bigger or better picture of who he is and what he went through and what his family went through. But it's also just like, you know, this family's going through so much, and do we really need to continue, like, you know, airing their dirty laundry when it doesn't do anything to, it's not vital information for the community to know. And so, like, it's just using that judgment, like, will this information help or will it harm? And so to let everyone in Lancaster County and then some know, like, yes, I loved this person and then he went and did this, or I was dating this person at the time when he did this, like, that I can't imagine. I can't even, like, begin to think how you'd feel if you came out and said that, like, I loved this person who did this horrible thing.
None of the journalists that worked on this case would say they did a perfect job. There were mistakes made, ones that they continue to think about, whether it be misused terms or even articles that didn't need to be written about at all.
Yeah, so I actually wrote a story about how Justo Smoker and Linda were distantly related. I still stand by that story, but, you know, I was a new journalist. And so I think, like, I did make a mistake in saying how that was relevant to the story. And so now I know, I can say, it was relevant because it lets us know that, you know, they were, I think, fourth cousins or something like that, which in Lancaster, you know, everybody's related. However, like, it helps us understand better what kind of household Justo would have been raised in, right? It would have let us know, okay, so he did, like, maybe he spoke Pennsylvania Dutch, or like, I believe one of his either his father's grandma, or like one of either his parents or his grandparents, they were Amish. And so there's, you know, there's a chance that, like, he knew Pennsylvania Dutch words, or he at least grew up in a community or in a family that had, you know, similar values to that of Linda's. And he would have run in circles that may have been similar, you know? And that was something that I didn't make clear enough in my story. And so LMP got a lot of, like, lash back for that. And I like, people were lashing out, and I get that. I do. That was a mistake. And, you know, I wish I could go back and change it now as I'm reflecting on it. But, you know, it's unfortunate that when things are printed in a newspaper, like, there's no really, you can issue a correction. But once it's printed, it's out there, it's in the world. And so that's one thing that, I think about fairly frequently, about how I could have done better.
But despite the mistakes they felt as though they made and the work they wished they could redo, there was still a strong sense of pride in the journalistic work they accomplished. And at the core of it all, it was the teamwork that filled them with much-needed satisfaction.
I'm proud of how we handled it. I'm proud of how we chased it. I'm proud of our reporting and tenacity in following up and getting as much information as we can. And I'm proud of everybody who helped out with that, because I think it was, as far as reporting it goes, I mean, it was as much of a team effort that I've ever experienced at this paper, and any paper, really. This was the biggest team effort coverage that I've been involved with, and I've been involved in some other things, like national attention-wise. Like, once he was convicted, then it kind of became a separate thing, and it shifted from, like, breaking news to, like, more over to Dan's plate. And I'm happy that I was able to be involved in such great journalism and great reporting throughout that, even throughout the conviction of Smoker.
It didn't seem to matter what time of night or whatever. I mean, everybody was putting in mega hours on this. I mean, you would see or learn of a development, because we're all connected on Teams and stuff, even though we're supposed to shut down at a time, you just get invested. So then you would, you know, you could turn to anybody, and it wasn't just like, you know, that I was available at night on my time off. You know, other people were too, or be like, hey, I've done all I can on this. My brain is fried. Can you give it a read? Make sure I haven't made any mistakes. Or there are people who are much better at putting things into the content management system and making them look nice, you know, that way. And there were definitely times I did that. I'm just like, you know, I know this could be better. I'm just shot. Can somebody, you know, take the ball? So definitely, definitely great collaboration.
There was a dedication there too, keeping these journalists tied to the story day after day. Even when it seemed fruitless, they were there on the scene.
I would spend an entire shift at, like, the fire companies where, you know, they were hosting the searches. And I wasn't just waiting for, you know, a ping to say, like, oh, they found her. You know, like, I put a lot of time and energy into making sure that I was there and I was seen and I was heard while they were searching for her. The story meant a lot to me, so I was going to put my time and energy. And, like, yeah, it was really annoying and really frustrating to, like, have to spend an entire day working out of my car. That's not ideal, but also, you know, I wanted to make sure that if anything developed, I was there. We were there. We weren't going to get, like, a 30-second clip and then disappear. Or, like, B-roll and then dip. We were going to spend our time making sure that if something did happen, we were there.
But for some, this dedication may have come off as questionable. For the reporters at LNP, their dedication was driven by a need to keep the community informed and broadcast all necessary information on Linda's case. But from an outsider's perspective, it's hard not to be aware of the media's past history. There's a long list of names of white women who have received the spotlight of national media attention. Gabby Petito, Elizabeth Smart, Lacey Peterson. It's not that these crimes don't deserve the attention they receive, but it's hard to ignore the countless other women and men that are overlooked purely because they don't fit into the image of a white, middle-class girl. There's Stephanie Flores, Donna Cook, and Alexis Patterson, just to name a few on the list of cases. It's such a prevalent issue that social scientists have even coined the term missing white woman syndrome, and most news outlets aren't aware of what they're doing.
I know sometimes in the media, the media gets beat up for when, you know, paying a lot of attention to like a pretty white girl who goes missing. And this was a young woman who happened to be white, but I don't think that that was the driving factor in this. What was the driving factor was she was from a different community that people don't know about, that there's, you know, they stay to themselves, they don't just randomly go missing, you know. So that drew the public's interest and therefore drove our interest. Plus, it was somebody, you know, in our community. But I think the media definitely is guilty of the putting too much attention on quote the pretty white girl who goes missing. And you know, that's an undeniable fact and something I try to be cognizant of. Just thankfully that doesn't happen too much here.
And I think sometimes news outlets take advantage of the fact that people go crazy for like missing white women specifically. Like people are just so interested in, you know, finding out what happened that it's like I think it's really disrespectful in the way that some news outlets just know that, yeah, writing a story about Linda Stoltz who's going missing, that's going to get them clicks, and just trying to milk all they can out of situations like that. When there is a family at home who is, you know, devastated. There's two families at home devastated, you know, with like the Smoker family and the Stoltz family. They both are really going through it.
As time goes on, the spotlight on Linda Stoltz's case has begun to dwindle. There are no longer daily updates or breaking news stories written in the late hours of the evening by a news team desperate to keep the public informed. Instead, there's an occasional article or a passing headline, just as it goes with every other case. But even as the amount of time the story takes up in their lives winds down, Abby King, Ty Lohr, and Dan Neefen continue to have a strong connection to both the case and the work that they did during those long months.
I think every story I've ever done, or every video I've ever made, or every person I've ever talked to, I think I take something away from that. So I covered her funeral a couple months, I guess it was 6 months ago or so now, but this summer, and that was like a harrowing thing to see, like to watch. And we knew where the funeral was taking place, but we weren't going to be in the funeral. We needed to document it because it was the last chapter in this terrible incident. But how do you do that kind of respectfully in these kind of situations? So to do that, I mean, I just kind of staked out the, you know, for lack of a better term, staked out the cemetery, and I just basically made loops. And on my one loop, I was coming up the road, and they had shut it down right in front of the cemetery, which was great. I counted every buggy that came through. I think that's the thing that I take away from these. I remember weird details. Like, I remember there were 69 buggies, and I remember, like, the little kid's face looking at me, and, like, I remember wondering if that was, like, a relative or if it was just a church member or something like that. It's a job. It's our job. We come here and we do this stuff, but you definitely take away things from it. I wouldn't say it had an emotional toll or affected me personally, but when I think back on those things, like, those things are, like, locked in my memory. For sure. I mean, the funeral, and I remember, like, the first time I saw Who's the Smoker in person, those kind of things, like, stick with me.
You know, I lived in Lancaster, and so there were plenty of times where I'd just be, like, driving. I'd be on my way to church or something, and, you know, driving past where she had last been seen, and just wondering, like, am I going to somehow see her? Am I going to spot her? Just by chance. It like took up a lot of my time. Like I was really invested in this story. yeah, it took up a lot of my, like, my brain space, you know, because it was so scary, and so it hit close to home.
While reading these endless articles from countless news sources, it's easy to forget that Linda was a real person. She was a young girl who had her life cut off too soon, not just a victim that could be used to sell for more views. On the other hand, there's Justo Smoker, the man who took Linda's life and left her family wondering for months about what could have happened to their daughter. There was a story behind Smoker too, a dark, tangled web of family history and past crimes. Thank you for listening to this episode of Keystone Crimes. New episodes are posted bi-weekly on all podcasting platforms. Please like, leave a review, and subscribe for more.